June. Mr. Ban Ki-moon got Saudi Arabia to use a really big spoon. The Saudis boost oil production to save the global economy. June Moon Spoon. You can't make this stuff up. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 16th, and what looks like an historic boost in oil production by the Saudis is keeping oil prices down or flat this morning. Also, receding waters in Iowa reveal heartbreaking devastation. Some disturbing revelations about the trade in nuclear secrets, a plan to re-regulate the airlines, and golf's U.S. Open in miniature. That and all the news. Oil prices hovered near $134 a barrel in Asian trading as markets digest the weekend news that Saudi Arabia plans to boost production by 200,000 barrels a day. This after UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met with the Saudi oil minister yesterday. Floodwaters are expected to start receding in Iowa City later today, and hundreds are still waiting to return home to assess the damage. Now the focus is shifting to the rising banks of the Mississippi River in western Illinois. The Illinois National Guard spent the weekend helping with sandbagging operations.
President Bush met with British Prime Minister Gordon Brown this morning to address Britain's involvement in Iraq and the nuclear standoff with Iran. On British TV yesterday, President Bush defended his legacy.
I want it to be said about George W. Bush that when he finished his presidency, he looked in the mirror at a man who did not compromise his core principles for the sake of politics.
More in a moment about the British Prime Minister's announcement that Iranian assets are going to be seized over nuclear issues. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has made a surprise little trip to Lebanon today to meet with government leaders. She hopes to bolster the troubled country's new president as rival political leaders struggle to form a new government.
California today becomes the second state to allow gay couples to get married. Marriages will start just after 5 p.m. today, and the clerk's offices in many counties will be open late to accommodate eager couples. The L.A. Lakers and Tiger Woods both stay alive in weekend sports action. The Lakers beat the Celtics 103-98 to bring the NBA Finals back to Boston for a sixth game. And the U.S. Open goes mano-mano today as Tiger Woods plays an 18-hole playoff round with Rocco Mediate. The two tied on the 18th hole, the final, supposedly final round yesterday.
Stocks were mixed last week, but capped the week with gains. The Dow rose 165 points to 12,307, while the S&P surged 20 points, and the NASDAQ composite added 50 points. Moon Spoon June. That's what I was trying to, you know, sort of poetry there at the top.
Bunky, I thought it was
moon,
quite eloquent spoon. Myself.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, yes. But we have lots for you to respond to this morning, and none of it should be poetry, okay? Devastating flooding in the Midwest and wildfire. Has the weather ever been worse? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're also talking about disturbing revelations about nuclear proliferation. Is the genie out of the nuclear bottle? If so, tell us your story. How can we get it back in? And finally, should the government just take over the airlines?
Would that fix everything?
Yeah, we have an interesting proposal to re-regulate the airlines by someone who used to run an airline. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Moon Spoon June. Ban Ki-moon. Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we mentioned at the top of the hour, this is a farewell visit to Europe and the European continent by President Bush. He's in London today with the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown and what could be a symbolic gesture or possibly an indication of a new front of sanctions against Iran that has been in disputes with the Europeans and the United States over nuclear issues was announced today in London by British Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
Today, Britain will urge Europe, and Europe will agree to take further sanctions against Iran. First of all, we will take action today that will freeze the overseas assets of the biggest bank in Iran, the Bank Melli. And second, action will start today for a new phase of sanctions on oil and gas.
So the question is, what is the dollar amount of these sanctions? The freezing of the assets of Bank Melli on the surface seems significant, but really is it? Joining us now is Naomi Grimley, who's political correspondent for the BBC World Service. She was there for the announcement. Thanks for joining us, Naomi. What do you make of this announcement?
Well, Gordon Brown is clearly offering the Iranians a choice here. It's a mixture of carrot and stick, because although you mentioned he talked about the freezing of overseas assets for this biggest bank in Iran and also this new phase of sanctions on oil and gas, he was also offering a bit of carrot to them. He was saying that there was an enhanced offer on the table if they wanted to accept it, including more political and economic partnership and also that crucial help with nuclear technology if the Iranians did want a nuclear program for civilian use. So a choice, really. And he was saying that they could either choose the path of confrontation or they had to resign themselves to the fact that there would be these tougher sanctions. And that was something that was backed up by President Bush. He said that it was important that the international community spoke with one voice. And he said that the Prime Minister's statement on Iran was very powerful.
You know, what the track record on the use of sanctions to get Iran to moderate its nuclear policy is not a terrifically strong one. There has been some progress, but it's usually been as a result of behind-the-scenes negotiations. How much of this do you think is the Prime Minister projecting a sort of a powerful personality in regional politics as President Bush leaves the stage?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I think diplomats are always juggling to get the rhetoric on this right. As we were talking about, it needs to be a mixture in Britain's view of incentives, but also further sanctions if those incentives are not acted upon. One thing that President Bush added was that all options were still on the table. He's very keen to keep on saying that. But he did say that his first choice was to see it diplomatically resolved. And that, of course, has always been Britain's line when it comes to Iran.
Do we see this as a passing of the torch in some sense? I mean, certainly President Bush's influence has never been at a lower ebb than he was on this entire trip. And while these are positive headlines in London in general, I mean, it doesn't appear as though Bush by himself is going to have much influence inside Iran.
I think at the moment there's this sense in London that although there will be a new president in charge of the United States come January, that President Bush is still, you know, Iran is still crucial to him in these closing months of his time in office. And so London just wants to make sure that there is a united front on this and that the European stance on Iran tallies up with the American one. So today there was very much a united front when it came to Iran, as there was with Iraq, because a lot of this press conference was taken up with what is going to happen in Iraq over the coming months.
And the British troops are likely to be withdrawn quickly. Any discussion about that?
Well, there have been reports in the newspapers over the weekend here in Britain that there was a difference of opinion between the two leaders when it comes to drawing down troops. Britain had indicated behind the scenes that there would be a further announcement by the end of this year. Now, both leaders have been at pains to stress this morning that they want the same thing in Iraq, that they accept that there's both a job to be done, which is the words that Mr. Brown used. But at the same time, President Bush was saying that both countries wanted to see their troops brought home and that that had always been the plan. So very much trying to play down those suggestions of a divergence in policy on Iraq.
All right. Naomi Grimley, political correspondent for the BBC World Service. Thank you very much for joining us.
Today, the Iowa River is expected to finally start receding in Iowa City. Hundreds of homes have been evacuated there, though it's not clear how many have suffered damage. Floodwaters are also rising in western Michigan after a second straight weekend of severe weather. And back in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 9 miles of the city are still underwater, and experts say it's not likely to recede fully for days. Randy Rundel manages some buildings there. He spent the last week piling up sandbags and boarding up windows. Good morning, Randy. What are you most worried about today?
Right now, what we're most worried about is the, well, of course, the welfare of the people in Cedar Rapids and along the Cedar River. Secondly, it's getting things restored safely, doing it right so nobody gets hurt in the recovery effort.
Now, you manage five buildings in downtown Cedar Rapids. Have you been able to get anywhere near any of them?
No, we've not been allowed to get into the buildings at all. I'm hoping this morning that they say that they have people in place at certain checkpoints where you can check in and they'll escort you to the buildings so we can get in and assess the damage that's been done.
Now, we've read some reports that people are getting a little frustrated with the checkpoints and trying to get in to either see their homes or to their businesses. Did you experience any of that frustration? Did you see others?
No, I didn't experience it. Actually, I have not been able to get back into Cedar Rapids since Thursday. My house is south of Cedar Rapids, about 15 miles, right on the Cedar River, and we've been dealing with the water ourselves at home right now.
And what's it like been in your, what has it been like in your neighborhood?
Well, I actually live out in a farming area. It's a rural, it's not really a neighborhood. It's just a few of us neighbors that live together along the river, surrounded by agricultural land. And it's been a real humbling experience watching that water rise
wow.
and continue to rise coming towards your home.
And what does it sound like?
The roar was just incredible. Thursday night and Friday, it was just unimaginable, the sound of it as it rushed across the road in front of our house. In fact, that road is gone now. They're going to have to completely rebuild that highway.
God. You know, Randy, my nephew, Nick, is a student at the university, and he's been telling me these amazing stories of the floodwaters have changed the ecosystem, that it, basically weird spiders and animals of all kinds are sort of roaming around in places you would never see them before. Have you noticed anything like that?
Well, yeah, my wife and I were standing in our front yard watching the river come up on Thursday, and all of a sudden, a large herd of deer came up out of the river bottom, heading right towards our house. Evidently, they'd realized the water was coming up, and they were heading for high ground themselves. And like you say, the spiders, I think the groundwater is forcing spiders up out of the ground, but we see a lot of spiders here anyway, so...
Have you seen any of the water receding in, you're saying, not your neighborhood, but in the area where you live?
Yes, the water started receding Friday night, and by yesterday evening, the water had dropped probably, I would guess, about 6-7 feet.
And what is your anticipation, or what do you understand is the forecast for Cedar Rapids?
Cedar Rapids, what I saw last night on the news, the water there had dropped approximately the same amount, maybe 8 feet in Cedar Rapids. It's still well above flood stage. In fact, we're still above the 100-year flood point, which we surpassed the 500-year flood.
Yeah, but it's still going to be some time before you get in to where you can manage the cleanup, right?
Right. Well, I'm hoping to get in there today, and this will be just an assessment. And then once we assess the damage, then we'll put a plan of action together to get the buildings back in shape.
Randy
again.
Rundle, resident of Ivanhoe, Iowa, near Cedar Rapids. Thank you. Thank you.
It's
a herd of deer.
Herd of deer. I'm surprised he didn't get the rifle out there in Iowa. Anyway, if the weather is on your mind, and you've been listening to these reports over the last couple of weeks, we want to hear your story. Has the weather ever been worse? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's one of your responses.
This is Kathleen Hanna from North Hailden, New Jersey, and I just wanted to say that I've been teaching for 35 years, and this is the first time on Tuesday that we ever had to close early because of the heat. So the weather's doing something interesting.
Heat waves, floods, wildfires. We want your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Has the weather ever been worse, or what do you think? Also, you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Also, we're going to talk about nuclear
proliferation and a story about whether some of Pakistan's top nuclear scientists, whether that's been sent out into the world.
Is the genie out of the bottle? If you think so, you can get in touch with us. Also, should the governments just take over the airlines? All on the table here at The Takeaway. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
International investigators have a bit of a mystery on their hands. They're trying to find out if Pakistan's former top nuclear scientist secretly shared blueprints for a sophisticated and compact nuclear weapon with people or governments that he wasn't supposed to. They worry he may have given the blueprints that investigators found on his computers to perhaps Iran, North Korea, or other countries sanctioned against having them. New York Times' David Sanger has been tracking this story for the past year. David, good morning. The father of Pakistan's nuclear technology, Abdul Qadir Khan, has been under house arrest since 2004. What have you learned about his ring? Is it alive and well?
The ring is not necessarily alive and well, but very few of its members, Adora, have actually gone to jail. And it's a pretty luxurious incarceration that Khan himself has. I was in Islamabad 2 months ago and drove by his house, which is in a very Tony neighborhood of the city, and there are a couple of pretty nasty-looking guards outside, but they seem more interested in actually keeping passersby from sort of lingering or ringing the doorbell than they do in keeping him on the inside. He's been traveling around a fair bit.
And let's talk about the nuclear weapon at issue here. They're calling them electronic blueprints. Is this something that can simply be emailed and forwarded?
It may be a little bit big to email, and you might, for some security reasons, not want to be caught doing that. But it certainly could be put on, say, a very large thumb drive or a series of CDs. So that's the big concern about this. You may recall that when the Libyans turned over their nuclear program in 2003, when they got caught, and they had gotten all of their stuff from Khan, they actually did have a weapons design that Khan had given them. But it was in big sort of blueprint form on paper. And when it got turned over to the investigators, it was still wrapped in the plastic of some dry cleaners who were down the road from Khan's house, which sort of amused everybody. Not everybody sends their bomb designs out to be dry cleaned. In this case, this has been found on computers that belong to the Khan network all around the world, and it's a much more sophisticated design. And it very closely resembles the design of the weapon that Pakistan tested in underground tests exactly 10 years ago.
But this nuclear weapon, it's described as sophisticated and compact. Are we talking about something that fits in a suitcase, or does it belong
in
a truck?
It would fit in a suitcase, but it would fit on top of a Shahab-3 missile, which is the Iranian missile, or a Nodung missile, which is the North Korean missile. And there's no accident about this, because North Korea, which has a pretty active missile business, actually was the supplier of the original designs for these missiles to both Iran and to Pakistan. So this one of the reasons that this is of more concern than the old Chinese design is that you actually could fit it on something that would make it deliverable. The Chinese one was big and heavy.
Well, let's not get into the details of the science too much, but we should point out that this is a uranium-based implosion weapon, if I'm not misunderstanding,
right.
that it basically compresses a ball of uranium And the what's so disturbing about these blueprints is if you could just send to somebody the sequence for producing that implosion, you basically speed up the testing to create such a weapon by perhaps as much as years, right?
That's right. You cut a lot of time out. Now, remember, what's the hardest part about building a bomb? It's getting the actual fuel. But as we've learned in the case of the Iranians, they're working on that pretty hard. In the case of the North Koreans who have plutonium weapons, they've already got it. So what this does is it puts on the market something that would sort of help somebody get to the last steps.
And who do you think might have those blueprints now, David?
Well, it's a great question. And this is the $64,000 question of this whole mystery. Because we know that it was on the computers of these networks, and we know that Khan did business at least with North Korea, Libya, and Iran. But if you follow his travels before he was arrested in 2004, you discover that he traveled all through the Middle East. He was, of course, in Syria, which just got caught trying to build a reactor until the Israelis went and redecorated it for them in September. He was, of course, at various times in Saudi Arabia. He was throughout Africa. So he was in a lot of places where there was weapons concern. And in the 4 years since, nobody's ever been able to find any evidence that he actually was selling them the full package of goods that he sold to North Korea and Libya and to Iran. Mm. But that doesn't mean that we understand what he was doing. And he isn't answering very many questions.
And the Pakistanis are not allowing U.S. investigators to have any conversations with him.
Nor are they allowing the International Atomic Energy Agency to have any to question him, because he's considered to be a national hero for having gotten them to the bomb.
Thank you, David Sanger. David Sanger reports for The New York Times. Now we have more headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello there. 28 minutes past the hour. The Iowa River is expected to finally start receding in Iowa City, Iowa today, but water is still rising in the Midwest. California's same-sex couples can officially get married starting at 5:01 Pacific time this evening. And the FCC says satellite broadcasters XM and Sirius can merge. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, fresh out of a meeting this morning with President Bush, made a major commitment to the war in Afghanistan.
Today, Britain will announce additional troops for Afghanistan, bringing our numbers in Afghanistan to the highest level.
The increase of UK troops in Afghanistan won't top more than 8,000 soldiers. In Sri Lanka, a dozen police officers have been killed and more than two dozen other people were wounded in a suicide bomb attack. A suspected Tamil Tiger suicide bomber on a motorbike blew himself up near a police building in a northern town. Amtrak is suspending service between Chicago and destinations to the north and west because of flooding across the Midwest. Amtrak says it'll provide chartered buses for some destinations but isn't offering any travel alternatives to or from cities in hard-hit Iowa. And finally, we wrap up the news headlines with Whoopi Goldberg.
The 2008 Tony Award goes to In the Heights.
In the Heights picked up the Best New Musical, but the bigger winner at Broadway's Tony Awards last night was the revival of South Pacific, which danced off with 7 awards. And Passing Strange, a musical that we featured here on The Takeaway, won the Best Book of a Musical.
Yeah, it did all right. And In the Heights did all right. We featured that last Friday as well. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses 2 boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We're getting responses on the issue of how bad can the weather get. Also, the disturbing revelations about nuclear proliferation that Adora was talking about a moment ago with David Sanger. We'll play some of those in a moment. But what are we to do with the airline industry? I mean, should the government just take it over? We have an interesting proposal to re-regulate the airlines from someone, Bob Crandall, who used to run an airline. But first, listen to this.
Please make sure that your seatbelt is securely fastened. Seatbelts can be purchased for $5. To fasten, insert the metal fitting into the buckle and tighten the buckle by pulling the loose end away from you. To release, purchase a release flap for $7.
That's right, only $7. Exact change, please. It may be a joke to Mad Television, but the struggling airline industry is no joke to the people who ride on the airlines, and it's certainly no joke to the industry itself, where the business model is as perplexing as ever, with fuel prices high and revenues as low as they could possibly be. The question is, the airline industry has lost about $13 billion, according to Wired magazine, since it was deregulated in 1978. Is it time to re-regulate the industry? Well, we have on the line with us someone who's benefited probably as much as anyone from deregulation, but probably knows as much about the industry as anyone as well. The former CEO of American Airlines, Bob Crandall, joins us. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, you proposed in an op-ed that the industry perhaps should be re-regulated. What sorts of regulations are you envisioning, and would it be like the industry was back in 1978 or fundamentally different?
No, I think, John, proposing is very much regulation light. What I think we do need is we need a national transportation plan. Really makes no sense in an era when we're paying nationally $600 billion, $700 billion a year to import crude, not to have a viable rail system, for example. It makes absolutely no sense to have airplanes sitting on the runway at LaGuardia spewing fuel out the tailpipe, because we've got twice as many flights scheduled at any given time as LaGuardia can accommodate. Makes absolutely no sense, in my view, to have very low entrance standards for new carriers. So they come in, they run for a couple of years, they undercut the price structure, and then they go away. It doesn't make any sense to have bankruptcy statutes that allow companies to go bankrupt, cut their costs, come back in, and undercut the price structure for those who haven't gone bankrupt. In fact, virtually nothing we do in the aviation business makes much sense. We seem to have this peculiar attitude in Washington that if you make a plan, somehow you're vaguely socialist.
So do you think the government has the power to do all that you're talking about, control the supply of flights and the availability of planes, keep price structures at a high enough level so that there can be a guaranteed profit in the industry, and enforce a broader transportation policy that is more strategic, as you were saying earlier?
Well, I think they have the ability to do so, John. I mean, we've got a Department of Transportation. I would think, as a minimum, that the Department of Transportation ought to make the necessary plans so our bridges don't fall down, so our highways are maintained in some sensible way, so that we have a national rail system for short-haul journeys, say, up to 300 miles. I'll give you a great example. It makes absolutely no sense to fly airplanes between New York and Washington. When a train, for example, can deliver probably 10 times as many passenger miles per gallon of fuel as an airplane can, what are we doing flying airplanes between two cities that are, 300 miles apart or thereabouts? I mean, the fact of the matter is we don't have any kind of national transportation planning. We keep negotiating international aviation agreements, which are far more beneficial to foreign airlines than they are to our own. And then we complain about the fact that our airline system is going to pot.
Bob, Adora Udoji here.
Yes.
Essentially, what you're suggesting, would that result in fewer flights and higher fares, but more reliability and consistency in the price of those fares, something like what Europe does?
Well, Adora, very much so. The fact of the matter is there are going to be fewer flights. All of the major carriers have announced that they're going to make very large capacity cuts come fall. So we're going to have fewer flights, but unless we have some kind of regulatory oversight, we're going to continue to have dramatically different their structures market by market. And you're not going to get a circumstance, for example, where the number of flights at a given airport, take LaGuardia as an example, take Chicago O'Hare as an example, where the number of flights get matched to the capacity of the airport. The airlines simply do not have the ability to do that on their own. There's got to be some level of government oversight. And, in fact, if you look around the world, there are virtually no markets in the world, no countries in the world that have a comprehensively deregulated, completely unregulated aviation business. Aviation is a utility. It is, to some extent, like telecommunications. We've got to have a viable aviation business in the United States if we want to have, if people want to have the ability to move around with some degree of facility and at halfway reasonable prices.
Bob Crandall, thank you very much. Bob Crandall is the former CEO of American Airlines. The airlines are like a utility. That's a takeaway. Some of you are responding to our takeaway questions. Among them, what do we do about regulating the airlines? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Should the government just take over? What about the nuclear genie? Is it out of the bottle? Here's one of your responses.
The nuclear genie came out of the bottle way back, you know, I think it was either 1944 or 1945. Well, why are we the only ones that should have it?
It will be 1945. Now, headlines from Femi Okay.
Hello there. 21 minutes to the hour. President Bush says the U.S. can help calm tensions on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Gay marriage becomes legal in California tonight. The floodwaters are expected to recede in Iowa City, but the rising Mississippi now threatens parts of western Illinois. And the L.A. Lakers beat the Boston Celtics 103-98 to bring the NBA Finals back to Boston for a sixth game tomorrow night. Farmers in Argentina have launched their fourth strike in as many months in a heated protest against tax increases on food exports. The bitter three-month standoff has left grocery store shelves empty. Honda is developing the first commercial production of a car powered by a hydrogen fuel cell. The medium-sized four-seater runs on hydrogen and electricity and gives out water vapor. And Rocco Mediate and Tiger Woods tied the US Open yesterday at a one-under par after Woods nailed a 12-foot birdie putt on the last hole. Today, the playoff for the title. Mediate says he's excited.
I have nothing to lose. I really don't have anything to lose. I can't believe I'm in this situation. I can't wait to go see what I got against the man.
Oh, that sounds good.
He's going to get crushed. He's going to get crunched.
I'm just excited to listen to it. It's like, he is ready.
Yeah.
Mano, as Adora said earlier today.
Good luck.
He did not eat his breakfast this morning, I guarantee you.
I think he needs like oatmeal, oats. He needs oats to take on the Tiger.
I liked John's suggestion last week that Tiger Woods should be blindfolded and then he could go out there and it would be a fair fight with his rival.
And he was hobbled and look how he's doing.
I know.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Can't stop Tiger. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You know, Adora, this weekend it was really easy for the Incredible Hulk being green. You know how much it made?
A lot.
55 million. Yes, indeed.
There are aspects of my personality that I can't control.
Ed Norton playing the Incredible Hulk. It was kind of a redo from the 2003 Hulk, which was a little too introspective, a little too psychological. This one, a lot of bang bang, a lot of smash up. And you reviewed it. You called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and gave us some reviews. Here are the first reviews of the Incredible Hulk.
It's not as good as Iron Man, but it's a lot better than the 2003 version with Eric Bana.
It was better than expected. There's so much action in this movie that it gets monotonous at times.
Mixed reviews, but still $55 million. But people had a lot to say specifically about the story and what it lacked and what it did have that they enjoyed. So let's take a listen.
Sadly, the movie's also lacking one critical muscle, a heart. Edward Norton does what he can, but is ultimately so distant and so busy running that he doesn't humanize the situation. And all the action in the Marvel Universe can't make up for that.
This version of The Incredible Hulk has borrowed perhaps too much from the genre to bear the label Incredible, though it is certainly more credible.
if a do-over means the chance to watch Edward Norton share screen time with Lou Ferrigno, yeah, I'm willing to cut Marvel some slack.
We don't care about the gamma rays. We don't care about how he got to be the Hulk. We just want to see some stuff blow up, and that's what it is. A great summer popcorn flick.
I do personally care about gamma rays. But if you are sick of The Incredible Hulk, there was certainly another option this weekend. If you don't see dead people, or if you love seeing dead people, there was M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, a brand new flick. The premise there was toxins in the air cause mass suicide.
What's going on? You can't just leave us here.
Sir, we lost contact.
With whom?
Everyone.
Ominous music.
But did the reviewers think it was ominous?
For a movie called The Happening, in the end, not that much does.
But hey, let's keep the focus on making the characters miserable, not the audience.
It's just dreadful.
But it made $31
million. Harsh.
It did well. $31 million is what The Happening made. It lost out to Kung Fu Panda at $34 million in its second week. But, you know, it's a franchise that probably is going to continue. M. Night Shyamalan, of course, you know, famous for all of his scary movies. The reviews weren't really mixed, though, on this.
This disaster fair pits nature against man and something lethal in the air that inexplicably precipitates mass suicide, which is actually a refreshing change of pace, by the way, from the usual running around and killing each other.
But the film is told with such stilted, portentous dialogue, and the tone is so self-important that it feels downright goofy.
Shyamalan's great at an ominous foreboding, but there's no logic to his plot and no payoff.
M. Night finally dispenses with what has become his trademark, the twist ending, though the final irony might be that The Happening could have used one.
Self-important mass suicide. Twist,
and we should add, it's Mark Wahlberg and indie starlet right. Zoe Deschanel.
But thanks to our reviewers, Liz Ball, Karen Dahlstrom, Susan Granger, Ken Lieberger, Nell Minow, Joe Lozito, Prairie Miller, Scooter Thompson, and of course...
Deborah Young.
Yes. All of your reviews we love. We listen to them all. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE because the best reviews are words of mouth. And that's what we have here at The Takeaway.
And next
words
week it's Get Smart and The Love Guru next Monday.
Can we get Steve Carell? Dylan, book Steve Carell, will you please? Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. More sign of tension on the Afghan-Pakistan border coming days after an American air and artillery strike killed 11 Pakistani paramilitary soldiers in the border region. Militants reportedly crossed over from Pakistan, killing Afghan and coalition troops, provoking Afghan President Hamid Karzai to threaten to send troops over the border into Pakistan to confront Taliban militants. Barbara Plett covers the region for the BBC World Service. Barbara, how has Islamabad responded to this threat of a strike against Taliban militants inside Pakistan?
If you look at how the Pakistanis have responded, it seems doubtful that they've taken it literally like that. I mean, they did feel his comments were inappropriate. The foreign minister here summoned the Afghan envoy. He also said that Pakistan would defend its territorial sovereignty, and he said Mr. Karzai's comments were irresponsible. But if you talk to observers and listen to what they're saying, they kind of interpret it as more of bluster that Karzai was trying to distract from a big prison disaster that took place this week. The Taliban managed to blow up the prison in Kandahar. 1,100 prisoners escaped, including about 400 Taliban. But I think there is a concern here in Pakistan that Mr. Karzai may be taking his cue from the Americans, who have definitely been getting more aggressive about direct intervention in Pakistan's tribal areas, which they do through airstrikes.
Well, if you itemize the details, including the prison strike that you talked about, which released 1,100 people throughout the country, it's certainly a disturbing menu of powerlessness for the Afghan president. I'm wondering if his attempts to threaten Pakistan are more for U.S. consumption than for regional consumption, and that he's trying to project that he's stronger than he really is.
There may be some of that. He has just come back from an international donors conference in which $20 billion more dollars were pledged to reconstructing and rebuilding Afghanistan, which is not nearly as much as he asked for, but which is still a considerable amount. Alongside that, though, there was criticism of him, of his performance, about corruption within his government, about not doing enough to stop the drug trades and various other things. So I think he probably is under a fair bit of pressure. And Pakistan and Afghanistan do have quite a tense relationship, especially over the past 4 or 5 years. And it is not unusual for allegations to fly between them about problems on the border, about who is supporting the Taliban and who isn't and who isn't doing enough. So it's possible that he has returned to this rather familiar kind of rhetoric because of that. Although I should say he has never actually has said that he would be sending troops across the border before.
Right. Well, you know, Barbara, there's a long tradition of the Taliban working with Pakistan, either overtly or covertly. It does seem with the events of the last few weeks that the Taliban are virtually free to raid Afghanistan almost anywhere in the country, and certainly operate freely across the Pakistan border. What are the broader implications of that?
Well, there is a process going on right now where the military is not pressuring the Taliban like it was last year. And that is because they're trying to make peace deals with the Taliban to prevent them from striking inside Pakistan. Hundreds of people were killed over the past year because of suicide attacks and other attacks within Pakistan. The Taliban having decided sometime in the middle of last year that the army really had turned its back against them because of its military work in the tribal areas. So I think what's happening in Pakistan is the decision has been made that the strategic threat is internal. That is, it's from the Taliban, and therefore peace deals
wow.
need to be met.
Well, it sounds like Pakistan is willing to allow Afghanistan to be the sacrificial lamb in the mission of peace with the Taliban, with its own government.
Well, I don't think they would put it that way, and they do continually stress that they are committed to fighting what's called the war on terrorism. I think what the Pakistanis are a bit fed up with is that they're constantly being told to do things to stop the Taliban from crossing the border, to do this and to do that. They're always seen as the fall guy and the bad guy in the process, whereas they have actually suffered a lot.
Reporting on persistent tensions between Pakistan and Afghanistan, Barbara Plett, BBC World Service in Islamabad. Thank you, Barbara.
It was one fantastic day at the U.S. Open yesterday at Torrey Pines, California. 45-year-old Rocco Mediate was so very close to winning yesterday, but there was a Tiger Woods in his way. Tiger hit a 12-foot birdie putt to tie Rocco at a 1-under par yesterday after 4 rounds. That has forced a playoff for the first time in 7 years at the Open, and that will happen today. Meanwhile,
do we have Tiger on the line?
No, we don't have Tiger on the line. But we did call Matt McLaughlin, who knows something about victory at the U.S. Open. Good morning, Matt.
Hey, how you doing?
I thought you were the 2008 U.S. Open champion.
Well, in miniature golf.
In miniature golf. If you were playing Tiger today, you think you'd beat him? He was putting pretty well over the weekend.
Oh, yeah, I saw some highlights. He sinks some really long putts. He's a great putter. Yeah. It'd be interesting if he came out and played our game. If he came out and didn't practice, I could probably take him. But once he got some practice, he would be tough.
Yeah, he has operations on both knees, and he doesn't practice. Then maybe you got a chance, right, Matt?
Yeah, right. Yeah, he has a great mental game, and we all know he's just incredible out there.
Matt, tell us about your season. What does that look like?
Well, I mean, so far I've played 3 miniature golf tournaments. I've happened to win them all. One in Branson, Missouri, then the U.S. Open up in Boothe Bay, Maine. Now I won this tournament here in Sedona, Arizona, so I'm on a roll right now.
So can you retire? I mean, are we talking millions here?
Yeah, right. Nah, really. Just probably, I think I've won about a little over $4,000 so far. I mean, that's nothing major, but, you know, it's great wins. Some good players out here in the miniature golf tour, and it's fun. great. It's good to win.
It must be hard to get some attention when you have Tiger and the other golf pros pulling in millions and millions of dollars and being shown on a network of television. Bob Detweiler, commissioner, how hard is it to kind of get people to know about your miniature golf?
Well, it's getting easier because of people like you. We appreciate all the coverage you can give us. The United States Pro Mini Golf Association and the tour is getting bigger all the time. And because of people like Matt, who is the Tiger Woods of miniature golf, we're getting more coverage in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. Everybody's picking up on this and all the TV networks. We've been on every one of them. And I'd say in the next couple of years, we're going to take on the Tiger Woods and take on the PGA on the
tournament. That's some really big talk, but let's get down to some nitty-gritty.
We think
miniature
like
golf.
And that's
no. We want you to explain it to us. We think miniature golf, when we think windmills or clown faces, we think of fun times, but what you're talking about is a sport, and it's not about windmills. Explain it to us.
No, windmills are in the past. That's a long time ago. I didn't realize you were that old, but the miniature golf today is just like PGA-type greens, undulations and sand traps and rocks and stuff like that. So,
how many meets a year?
How many tournaments?
Tournaments, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we have about 35 tournaments a year and growing, getting more all the time.
And it's not just here in the U.S., it's also overseas, right?
Worldwide, yes.
Bob, don't you need to lose mini? A mini kind of sort of makes you seem like you're smaller, you know?
I agree with that. In fact, I'm trying to switch that to the
Foreshortened
World Putting Association.
World Putting Association, that's good.
Yeah.
Foreshortened golf, slightly less golf.
No, I think it's more golf. Because,
more golf.
The major part of golf is putting, and we sink putts like Matt sinks putts every hole, not just now and then like
That's
Tiger.
Right.
We do it every hole. We make aces all the time.
Every hole. Thank you, Bob Detweiler, and thank you, Matt McCaflin. Bob Detweiler is the commissioner of the U.S. Pro Mini Golf, and Matt McCaflin is the 2008 U.S. Open Mini Golf champ.
All putts all the time.
All putts all the time. It's not easy putting, that is.
Well, no, I wouldn't know. I really wouldn't know. I'm not much of a golfer myself.
But you do know about responses that we've gotten to some of the questions that we've thrown out during our show.
That's right. And one of the responses is on the Shyamalan movie, The Happening, right here.
Hi, my name is Craig. I'm calling from Plymouth, Massachusetts. I'm calling in regards to the reviews I heard for The Happening. I completely agree with all of them. But one thing that hasn't been mentioned either in reviews on the radio, TV, or in print is the technical errors in the movie. I don't know if they were intentional. There was a boom mic visible in the top of the screen of the movie.
I love that.
That's
continuity problems, yeah. There's actually websites you can go to look for continuity problems or to report continuity problems or you know, boom mics that slip for any kind of a movie. I love that sort of stuff. People are definitely paying attention.
But you have to wonder if it was on purpose. It must have been. They would have noticed.
Here's something about the Tonys over the weekend. We talked about Passing Strange last Friday. Hey, I'm a 47-year-old black New Jersey woman who loved Passing Strange, the Broadway musical. I looked around at the audience and said, where are all the black people? The play was exciting, dynamic, and the music was outstanding. Stu and Heidi, that's the producer and co-producer, deserve all the accolades. Mondwane Harris is the name there. We want your responses to anything on the show. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Nukes, the airlines, and weather were the subjects today. You can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Aviation is a utility.
Oh, that's the takeaway for today. Thank you, Dylan.
Sink the final pot, Adora.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience.
Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.